We're going to go on to case number five, and that is United States versus Simps.
May it please the court, I'm Sarah Shrupp from Northwestern Law School, and I represent the appellant, Robert Simpson, who is appealing his drug conviction pursuant to 21 U.S.C. 841A1. This court should reverse and remand for a new trial for two reasons. First, the prosecutor's improper inference during closing arguments that was based on improper propensity evidence denied Mr. Simpson a fair trial. Second, the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Simpson's Rule 33 motion in light of the remaining non-credible and less than overwhelming evidence of Mr. Simpson's guilt. Turning to my first point, during closing arguments and over defense counsel's objection, the prosecutor invited the jury to accept the following inference. The inference was that Simpson had engaged in so many drug transactions in the past that he couldn't even remember engaging in the one for which he was charged in this crime. This is nothing more than a once-a-drug-dealer, always-a-drug-dealer inference, and it's one that is improper under the law.
Well, didn't Simpson's counsel mention during his own opening and closing statements that Agent Hendon would testify Simpson had been a crack dealer in the past?
I don't know that he made that explicit reference to it, but if you look at the context of it and how it was used in closing arguments, that the significance of this statement that Hendon testified to becomes very clear.
But there was, I mean, as I said, counsel mentioned it, and then when it came out in Hendon's direct testimony, there was no objection, right?
There was no objection during the testimony, but if you look at the case as a whole and compare both the focus of the first trial and the fact that no inference was made and that this evidence and that the government consistently characterized this throughout both trials as a confession and then sort of popped this inference at the end, then there was really no reason for him necessarily to object at that point. Not only was this inference improper, it was highly prejudicial for two reasons. First of all, this court has held that there is a substantial danger of unfair prejudice from improper Rule 404B evidence because it serves as a substitute for the direct evidence in the case and invites the jury to find the defendant guilty based on improper grounds such as negative feelings about the defendant, his character, or his criminal activity. Second, the prejudicial impact of this inference becomes even more clear when, as I was just talking about, you compare the focus and result of the first case with the focus and result of the second case, the second trial. In the first trial, the government relied primarily on Emmanuel Bradley, the confidential informant, as the main pillar of its proof in that case. They further bolstered or supported Bradley's testimony with some testimony from Agent Hendon and Deputy Statt, and the result in that case was a mistrial. In the second trial, however, they omitted Bradley and substituted in his place Statt and Hendon's testimony, which was, by its very nature, weaker than Bradley's direct testimony of what occurred in that car. Therefore, in closing arguments, the government then offered this improper inference, and the result in the second trial was, of course, a conviction. Therefore, pretty much everything else remaining the same, except for the fact that the government substituted somewhat weaker evidence in the second trial and made this improper inference, shows that this inference clearly had a prejudicial impact on the jury. Now, the government almost ignores entirely the prejudice question in its briefs, but the prejudice resulting from this improper evidence and the inference drawn from it substantially outweighed whatever limited probative value these statements might have had, and we contend that the probative value is practically nil. Furthermore, the government has not met its burden of showing that these errors were harmless. This court has held that there is a heavy presumption of that improper 404B proof swayed the jury, and that often these errors go to the fundamental fairness of the trial. So, unless there is other evidence that overwhelmingly establishes the defendant's guilt, the improper evidence and the inferences drawn therefrom cannot be deemed harmless. In this case, it's clear that the evidence did not overwhelmingly establish Mr. Simpson's guilt. First of all, the first trial ended in a mistrial, which shows that the jury clearly questioned the strength of the government's proof in that case. Then, in the second trial, the evidence also clearly troubled the jury if you look at the questions that they submitted to the judge during deliberations, many of which questioned one or both of the government's main pillars of proof in the second trial, that is Statz and Hendon's testimony. For example, they wanted to know why no expert voice recognition techniques had been applied to the tape recording of the transaction. If one listens to that tape recording, which has been made a part of the record on appeal here, it's easy to see why. The recording is practically unintelligible, and thus it makes it almost wholly incredible that a layperson like Hendon could have legitimately identified Simpson's voice from that tape. The jury similarly questioned aspects of Statz's testimony as well, so they were clearly troubled by it. For the same reasons, that is the non-credibility of the witnesses and the remaining lack of overwhelming proof in this case, also demonstrates that the district court erred in denying Simpson's Rule 33 motion for a new trial. Accordingly, the combination of this improper inference during closings that was based on improper propensity evidence and the non-credible and otherwise non-overwhelming remaining proof shows that Simpson is entitled to a new trial. Thus, for the foregoing reasons, we would respectfully request that this court reverse and remand. And unless the panel has any other questions, I'll save my time for rebuttal.
Save your time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Rubenstein.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Dan Rubenstein appearing on behalf of the United States. The district court did not err by not sua sponte, and it did not plainly err by not sua sponte, precluding the government from presenting evidence of defendant Simpson's post-arrest Mirandized admissions.
I'm wondering how Simpson's statement to the police officer make it any more likely that he conducted this particular sale. I mean, at best he says he does not remember. Now, the reason he doesn't remember in part is because he does this kind of thing all the time, and a year has passed, and he can't recall specifics. But that part is all propensity evidence, to my way of thinking. None of it makes it more likely that he committed this particular crime.
Well, Your Honor, what he said specifically was, it's possible that I did this transaction, but I just can't remember. And he gave the here's why. And the part that the court's pointing out as to what might be characterized as propensity evidence is the here's why. And the here's why is, I've been not just a drug dealer or a heroin dealer, I've been a crack dealer, specifically the drug at issue in this case, for 3 to 4 years. He identified who his supplier was, which the record bears out.
In closing, the government argues that the inference to draw from Simpson's admission that he regularly sold cocaine, is that he's done it so many times he can't remember this one. How is that anything more than propensity? What does it add to your case about who pulled up on the van that day and sold cocaine? There are a lot of drug dealers out there who do so many deals that they can't be sure a year later if they conducted this one. I mean, are they guilty of this sale?
Well, I'm
really having a hard time with why this isn't propensity.
First of all, Your Honor, the government never argued, if you look specifically, and I'm going to read a part of my closing argument about that. I never argued propensity to the jury. What I did was say he said it was possible and gave the here's why, which is merely an explanation. It's not an argument along the lines of, well, we know he's a drug dealer and he's done it a lot of times, so you should presume, therefore, he's done it here, which clearly would be improper. What I said was, I want to talk to you for a moment about the confession that you heard from Special Agent Hendon. Special Agent Hendon told you his experience as an FBI agent, came in here and took an oath and told you exactly what the defendant told him. He read him his Miranda rights. You saw his written waiver. And go back and look at that when you're deliberating, the signed written waiver. And you know what the defendant told him. Yes, I'm a crack dealer. I've been a crack dealer for 3 or 4 years, and I could have done this transaction, 2 1/4 ounces, on behalf of Michael Hatton, but I don't remember, because my view of the inference being, and then there was an objection that was overruled, the inference being he's done so many, he couldn't remember this one. remember the details he gave. Michael Hatton. Mr. Hendon didn't know a Michael Hatton, but he did know a Rodney Bew, somebody else who was arrested in this investigation. But he told him who his supplier was and where he was getting it. That's all that was argued to this jury, Your Honor. Nothing about he's done it once, therefore he must do it again.
Can you cite any case addressing the intricately related doctrine that applied to a single transaction like we have here? In other words, this was not a series of transactions. It wasn't charged as a conspiracy. It was charged as a single sale. So I don't see how these other sales he conducted are intricately related, except to dirty him up with the fact that he is an admitted cocaine dealer. I mean, isn't that the point of 403B? That we cannot convict people of particular offenses simply because they may have committed other similar offenses at other times.
Yes, I can cite a case. And it's important for this court to note, Your Honor, that, of course, we're doing a post hoc analysis of this. Had an objection been raised to his confession or a motion to suppress been raised, of course, we would have, the district court would have had a chance to litigate and decide this properly. And so I submit to you that plain error is obviously the standard that must apply. The case is the Lott case from 2006, Your Honor. And there it was a 922G felon in possession case where this court approved the admission of the fact that the defendant there had dummy narcotics in his possession for giving the reason why he possessed the firearm in question. It wasn't a conspiracy case or anything of that nature. Just like here, the only point we were trying to do in giving the reasons why it was possible, defendant's own words, and I think the court would agree that any time a defendant says it's possible that I committed the crime charge, that part of it's admissible.
Right, but then it could have just stopped right there. It was possible, and without the explanation that he had sold drugs.
Yes, Your Honor, and I direct your attention to your opinion in the Senefer case where you talked about the inextricably intertwined doctrine and the need to talk about the circumstances surrounding the crime. So if it was left with just, it's possible I did this crime, of course I submit to you that the jury would wildly speculate as to what that means. Well, why is it possible? Why didn't he just say yes or no? And the reasons were put forth by Mr. Simpson's own words. It's possible because I've done it a lot of times. Here's who my supplier is. I've done transactions of that amount, 2 1/4 ounces, and that's why that statement fills that conceptual void, if you
will. Does Lott involve a single defendant engaging in a one-time commonplace drug transaction?
Yeah, it was a felon in possession case, Your Honor. It wasn't specifically
right.
A drug transaction. He possessed dummy bags of narcotics. But no, it was not. Maybe I misinterpreted your question, but it wasn't a conspiracy case or something like that. What's particularly important, I think, for this court to consider is there was no misconduct by the government in introducing this evidence, and nobody below saw it as such. The evidence was admitted without objection through the course of two trials. There was a motion in limine raised before the first trial to preclude evidence of other bad acts, not specifically relating to the post-arrest statements. And interestingly, after going through the trial run in the first trial, there was no renewal of that objection in the second trial, thereby showing the court that had there been some breach on the part of the government of this supposed agreement, surely defendant's counsel would have said, now having the opportunity to have the trial done over again, Your Honor, the government agreed not to put in this evidence of his statements, but then they went and did it anyway. And another important thing to note on the point of the inference, Judge Robner, is the objection that was raised by counsel was not specific to he's improperly arguing propensity. And the recent Gray case of this court makes it crystal clear that he must do so or also be arguing under the plain air standard. And Judge Williams, I'd like to point out also, responding to a question you posed to opposing counsel, his counsel, in fact, did argue the entire time through opening, through the cross-examination of Agent Hendon, and in closing, that this was a confession, but it's not believable that a man would confess and take this case to trial. If there are no other questions.
There is. I wanted to know where in the record we would find Simpson presenting his mistaken identity defense, because his defense seems to have been that the government didn't meet its burden of proof I mean, are those two defenses the same thing under your argument?
Your Honor, he asserted it throughout this trial, beginning an opening statement on the record of January 25th, 2005, at pages 18 and 20. This is defendant's opening statement, and if I might give you the quote, "The government is not going to be able to prove its case against my client because my client was not behind 402 Center Street at the time and the place the government said he was." That's clearly a mistaken identity defense. Then they also did it during the cross-examination of the case agent, Special Agent Brown, on 125 at page 107 of the record. Again, during the cross-examination of Agent Hendon on 126 at page 253, and then at least three times during closing argument at 126 at pages 291, 292, and 296. And if I might give you a quote, in closing, Mr. Simpson's counsel argued, "They could have gotten the right man. They could have found the right man. They didn't do that. They didn't go the extra mile like we expect them to do," them being the government. "We expect the government to go through our taxes and go the extra mile to make sure you get the right person, and that didn't happen here."
Can I ask you why there was no jury instruction limiting the use of Simpson's statement? Did the jury understand that they could not convict Simpson of this sale simply because he conducted other sales?
There was none, Your Honor, because the defendant, as was clear with defendant's counsel, was clear throughout his strategy of both trials, didn't ask for one, and no one envisioned his post-arrest statements under the rubric of 404B as other crimes evidence. So there was no instruction because one was not requested.
Okay. Thank you.
If the panel has no further questions, I ask respectfully that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I just want to respond briefly to a few of the government's points. First of all, they say that defense counsel constantly characterized it as a confession throughout. It's not true if you really look at the record. Defense counsel below either characterized it as what the government purports to be a confession, and that's in the Trial 1 transcripts at various places. And then he also, at various times, says, well, assuming arguendo, we accept this characterization of it, why would my client confess? So it isn't that defense counsel consistently also admitted that it was a confession throughout. Secondly, you have to take into
account... Did he ever concede that it was a confession?
He did say, you know, if this is a confession, or what they're essentially saying is a confession. But it wasn't as if he was proceeding on that. It was sort of a baseline assumption for another point he was trying to make.
Didn't his opening statement say it was a confession?
Well, what the government thinks is what they're purporting to be a confession.
He just read it.
No, he, in the first trial or the second trial, Your Honor?
I don't care which trial. I mean, he said he referred to it as a confession.
Yeah, he does call it confession, but it's not as if he's adopting that characterization.
Well, what he says in the opening is, he says the government has stated the jury would hear evidence from the agent that said, quote, "Yeah, I'm a big crack dealer." This is the defense attorney still talking. Mm-hmm. "Does it make sense to you that a person would confess to the FBI and would want to try this case?" And then in closing, he says, repeats it, "You heard me say this. Why would a man confess and then take this matter to trial? I mean, if you believe him that Hendon said, yeah, I'm a big drug dealer, I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years, it doesn't make any sense."
Yes, Your Honor, but if you look at that, he is calling it a confession. He is,
right.
But it's in the context of a different point. Why would he confess to this? And so that's making an initial assumption based on what the government
reported
to be.
What he's saying is that he thinks the case where the government is trumped up against your client.
Well, that was his point.
Yeah, well, that's his point. But it's not arguing that that wasn't a confession. It's just the whole thing was a trump, including the confession.
Well, if I can make a slightly different point as well, Your Honor, part of this is because the government characterized it as such throughout the whole trial, Hendon and whatever else.
They weren't alone, is what I'm saying. He joined in the characterization.
But the focus and the proof, the focus and use of that throughout the first trial and into the second, when he finally made that crucial inference in the second, it became clear what the government was really trying to do with this evidence. And that's when he objected. So the government has painted as a confession throughout trial. Then, notably, if you'll note, in the government's response to the Rule 33 motion, they then flip over and say, no, we've never contended that he admitted to the March 6th deal. Then in their appellate brief, they waffle back and forth again. They sometimes call it a confession, sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. It's no wonder that everybody was confused as to what, you know, how this was being characterized. And it only became clear when they drew that improper propensity evidence at the end. Judge Rovner, you were right that, you know, he did not assert a mistaken identity defense at trial. So any of those cases that the government cites are inopposite here. And the government tries to draw similarities between...
Wait. He didn't assert mistaken defendant?
Mistaken identity. No, yeah. He didn't.
He said, I wasn't there. Why didn't they go out and get the right guy? They didn't get the right guy? And that's
I'm sorry, Judge Bauer, but in those cases where mistaken identity defense has been proffered, it has been in the context of mostly, somebody else articulable was,
well, somebody
was there.
Else.
My brother was responsible, not me.
No.
This is more generalized, I didn't do it.
I didn't do it means there's a mistaken identity every time.
I think there is a distinction between those, Judge Bauer. I think that there's, you can sit back and what the government said, you can sit back and take pot shots.
And if I say I wasn't the guy... That doesn't mean that the fact you got me, you made it, is a case of mistaken identity?
I don't think so, because you have to
an
assert another identity. I'm sorry.
I don't have to say who it is. I just say it's not me.
But then wouldn't every case be a case of mistaken identity?
Any case you say it wasn't me is a case of mistaken identity. Mm-hmm. Any case.
But isn't that the premise underlying any reason that you would plead not guilty? So the cases that I looked at where a mistaken identity defense was put forward, the... Oh, and I see my
time. If the defense, you can go ahead and see, I get to talk whether the light goes on or off. If the defendant says somebody else did it and it was Harry, that's different than saying I didn't do it, but it's still a case of mistaken identity in any event.
But then every case would be that.
Yep, mm-hmm. Sure, right on the money.
So then there would be no...
Any time a defendant says you got the wrong guy, it's a case of mistaken identity, just by definition.
But that would then obliterate the distinctions that were drawn in the cases that relied on that.
Well, obliterate the distinction you're trying to draw in the argument. I agree with that. That's okay. I back.
May briefly.
You did
yes.
a nice job.
Okay.
Go ahead, keep going.
No, I'm finished. I'll wrap up.
No, go ahead.
And the last point I would just like to make that, these are not intricately related. This is not intricately related proof or series of transactions, because as we pointed out in our brief, it's clear that all of his testimony shows that the conduct that he testified to, I'm a small-time crack dealer, 33 to 4 weeks, was very dissimilar from the conduct that was charged in the indictment. The role of Hatton, he only did wholesale deals when he was doing them for Hatton. Hatton played no role in this case with Bradley, and therefore the government cannot rely on intricately related or any of those other things that attempt to link up his prior statements with the one that he was charged with. So for the foregoing reasons, we respectfully request that you reverse and remand. Thank you very much.
Ms. Shrupp, you were appointed, were you not?
I was, yeah.
Well, just as in the last case, you have our sincere deep thanks for the fine job you have done for your client and for taking on this responsibility.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
I joined
thank
in
you
that.
As well, Ms.
Congratulations. Thank you.
All right. Now, case number 6.